ACEC is excited to announce that registration is now open for its fall conference taking place in Marco Island, Florida, this October. That's right, after a year of Zoom and virtual meetings, we're excited to be bringing our fall conference back as an in-person event. And we can't tell you how excited we are to look forward to seeing you there in person for all of the content, networking, and education that the fall conference is known for. Log on to www.acec.org for more information. We can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to the Engineering Influence Podcast, presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACEC Life Health Trust. Cybersecurity has become a big issue in recent months as we've seen a surge in cybercrimes. Several have made the headlines, including ransomware attacks on the Colonial Pipeline, JBS Foods, the computer manufacturer Acer, and AXA, an international insurance company, which ironically, just days before the attack, announced that it would no longer reimburse some clients for ransomware payments. Experts predict that cybercrime activity is only going to increase. Today, we're going to talk about cybersecurity and cybersecurity insurance with Kevin Holland, who is with Lockton's Engineering and Design Practice.
Thanks for coming on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's an exciting topic and one that unfortunately is a little too prevalent right now.
That is true. So it has been in the news a lot, but I have the sense, and nothing to back it up, but the sense that a lot of businesses just don't believe it's going to happen to them. What's been your experience with the engineering firm leaders?
Well, you mentioned a couple of the really prevalent attacks that have shown up on the news recently. You can go back all the way to the early 2010s. Target had a huge breach. City of Baltimore had a pretty significant breach that maybe got botched in the response. There's also been some holes in the Microsoft system. Both the frequency and the severity of the attacks has increased. One strange one, the Oldsmar, Florida water treatment plant, which I know got quite a bit of press, wasn't necessarily the breach of a system that created a huge failure of any catastrophic proportion, but it certainly was a very real risk. Engineering firm leaders, unfortunately, I think are seeing these attacks not just in the news, but increasingly within their own firms. I'm not sure that this idea that they're not susceptible is still prevalent. The security of a firm's information and systems, it's really moved from a critical function of IT to it's a boardroom conversation topic right now. It's a real and present threat to these folks. And I think there is a growing and acute awareness among engineering leaders that this is a real issue. My sense is that most leaders are not only open to the possibility that they might get attacked, I think most of them have at this point experienced an attack of some sort, or at least had a really close call that's removed most doubt from their minds. A couple of the firms that I work with, we've got some clients that have experienced 7- and 8-figure losses, but we've also got a lot of firms who have a really telling anecdote about an experience they've had where it was a close call that maybe ended up costing them $25,000, $50,000 in fees, expenses, notification costs, but it really served as a wake-up call that this is a real issue. We need to make the investment in our cyber infrastructure, and there needs to be some education across the board. This is not any sort of amorphous or ethereal idea that this might happen. It's a real event that's happening. So I think we're moving away from the idea that this can't happen to me from the bigger firms.
What about the smaller firms? Do you feel like you're sort of gliding under the radar if you have a smaller engineering firm?
Yeah, for a while, I think there was this idea that smaller firms were saying, well, I moved to the cloud, so that's kind of solved my problem. But I think if those firms are feeling safer, it's a false sense of comfort, because a lot of these attacks, if we think about it from the bad actor's perspective, the people that are committing these attacks, they're not necessarily honing in all the time on one specific target that they really want to hack. they're looking at this as a frequency play. They want to get in there and hit as many folks as possible. And you mentioned the Colonial Pipeline, right? That created a big news play. The perception was that it shut down gas across a number of states. Those guys were really only demanding about $5 million to free the system, which is a drop in the bucket. So I think that speaks to the idea that they're not looking for one huge payout on any one deal. They're looking to infiltrate as many systems as possible. And they see smaller firms and larger firms, I think alike, in that they're trying to just get into systems. So the fact that they're attacking the Cassia software or the Microsoft software shows they're using a variety of almost Trojan horses to get into systems. And from that play, they can then extrapolate that into demands down the road. So smaller firms, I think, are seeing that this is a real deal, that they could be attacked. But even more so, I think that smaller firms and larger firms are being asked to demonstrate that they have cybersecurity protocols in place in order to participate on projects and to work with especially US government contracts.
Yeah, I don't remember the name of the CMMC or something like that.
Yeah, CMMC, and then the Biden administration's come out with some additional protocols for software providers that I think is gonna probably carry on down to contractors as well.
So for engineering firms, what are the most common types of cyber crimes that they face?
So there's the social engineering fraud. This is where the bad actor comes and pretends like they're somebody else to try to extort money. There's also an invoice manipulation event where the banking keys are changed on an invoice, either to a vendor or a client, and then the money gets wired to the wrong place. These are both very common attacks. But the one that's just hyper prevalent right now, though, is the ransomware attack, which is an extortion by a third party where essentially they lock up your system and make a demand in order to unlock that system. We're just seeing it across large firms and small firms alike.
So, this has all led to the creation of cybersecurity insurance. Has that become sort of a required insurance for engineering firms now, or do you feel like it's still optional?
Well, so it's an optional insurance, right? It's not a compulsory line of coverage. It's not mandated. But I think over the past 10 years, it was such an affordable line of insurance. The amount of coverage you could buy for a very low premium made it almost a throw in or you didn't have to think too much about it. It became an easy decision to just buy it or not. But now that firms are seeing an increased, not only frequency, but severity of cyber events, I think it's become just as necessary as other kind of voluntary lines like D&O insurance, property insurance, professional liability insurance. It's no longer an issue of whether or not it's needed. We're working with our clients more and more to determine how much should they be buying, what type of coverage extensions or sublimits should we be pushing for better results on, where's the right retention. So it's not a if we should buy coverage, it's what type of coverage, how much coverage should we be buying.
And as these crimes have gotten more prevalent, has it become more expensive?
Yeah, it really has. This has become one of the hardest lines of insurance, meaning that the market has said, we're going to be restricting the capacity and we're going to be restricting the coverage terms that we're offering. And we're also going to be asking for higher deductibles or retentions and higher premium rates. So the results in the market have varied, but very few firms have walked away from this last set of renewals feeling like they saved money by buying cyber insurance.
And what when you buy cyber insurance, what are you getting? What does it cover?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's really a changing situation. For a long time, there was something called silent cyber coverage, which was a cyber loss wasn't really excluded from a wide variety of insurance policies. So when a firm suffered a large event, and we've had several firms suffer, as we mentioned, 7- and 8-figure losses, you didn't just call on the cyber insurance policy because oftentimes there were only a couple million dollars of limits purchased there. We would also look to the property policy We'd looked at the kidnap and ransom policy, the crime policy. Really, it was, let's get creative. Let's make a claim on any policy that doesn't specifically exclude cyber and find a coverage trigger that can respond to this event. This has changed, however, because insurers have said, okay, we need clarity on whether our policy is going to cover cyber events or not. Lloyd's of London really led this charge. They mandated in a series of protocols that firms had to demonstrate if they were affirmatively covering or excluding cyber insurance from the policy to remove any doubt about it. So now the cyber insurance policy has become really a key element and one of the few policies that will be responding going forward. And the cyber policy is it's evolving, but there's a few key components. The cyber policy responds to two types of risk. First party risk, which is the losses that the cyber event has on the firm itself. And then the third party risk, which is what we've done to others as a result of a cyber event. And those first party risks kind of have component coverage pieces. So there's a piece of the policy that covers to the response to breach events. So if my system is breached, I'm going and there's a ransomware attack, for instance, I'm going to need to hire a legal firm to help represent me. I'm going to need a forensics firm. I'm going to need a response vendor to help me pay that ransomware attack if that's what I deem necessary. So that would be covered by the cyber policy. There's also network business interruption. So this is if my system gets shut down, either from an attack, if the service provider fails, in some cases you can buy coverage, or if I voluntarily shut down my system, after a certain time deductible, the cyber insurance policy would pay for those extra expenses and the business interruption losses. If I lose digital assets, if my property is damaged, in the cyber world, this is called a bricking coverage. So if I actually lose hardware as a result of this, it can respond. There's some reputational harm coverage. This isn't always included in a cyber policy, but it can be extended to cover it. So this would cover any PR or marketing or attorney's fees required. If I have a breach event, what I don't want to happen is my clients say I'm no longer trustworthy. And so this would pay to sort of market that idea that, hey, this was an event. It was a bad situation. However, we've made the proper fixes. And then, as I mentioned, the electronic theft of funds, that's the social engineering and invoice manipulation. Those are kind of first party triggers for coverage in a cyber policy. That third party aspect of it, this is going to be tied more towards privacy liability. So if I'm holding data too long, or if I accidentally release data, or if some bad actor releases the data that I hold for my employees, any personally identifiable information, I've got to notify those folks. There's also just a network security liability. Did I create a breach in somebody else's system? One area that's still evolving is this idea of regulatory liability. When I, there's the GDPR in Europe. There's California has a code. Colorado's got a code for privacy. This is evolving across the globe. When I have an infraction and I create a problem in one of these jurisdictions, the cyber insurance policy may be able to respond. Whether that jurisdiction permits a response from insurance is still being debated in a variety of jurisdictions. Then that third party also covers things like property damage to third parties, media liability. So if I infringe on a copyright or a trademark, and then technology E&O, some of the design firms have created their own software products. So if that software creates a problem or doesn't work as appropriate, the cyber liability policy, if it has a technology errors and omissions coverage to it, it would respond as well. But not only does it respond in case of an event, those cyber insurance policies also provide a number of benefits to help create a better cyber environment for a firm. Increasing your ability to protect against a cyber event is not only in the firm's best interest, but it's also in the insurance company's best interest. So we would recommend reaching out to your broker to make sure that you're getting the most out of your cyber insurance policy if you do have one already.
do the policies cover paying a ransom?
They do, but this is a changing space. And it's a bit of a tricky question there. France has no longer permitted cyber insurance companies to pay ransoms. There's a number of bad actors who have been sanctioned by the US federal government. So payment can no longer be made to those bad actors, but those are very specific bad actors. The insurance companies themselves, the ones that are writing this coverage, for the most part, are agreeing to respond to ransom demands. However, this coverage is changing. And if firms want to continue to have this ransomware protection, they're seeing some changes in the marketplace right now. I know this is going to be a recorded conversation. So as soon as I say something, I'm sure a week later, the market will have shifted a bit. However, what we are seeing is that the limits provided by insurance companies for ransomware are being reduced significantly, and or the cyber insurers are saying that they want a co-insurance clause, meaning they want the firm to participate in that response. So perhaps they'll pay, but they want the firm that suffered the ransomware attack to share in that payment, not just at the deductible level, but also all the way up for the ransomware.
Are there any other key areas that aren't covered?
Yeah, I mean, the one that folks forget to talk about is the losses that exceed the limits you purchased. That's not a covered loss, right? So we're really working with firms to understand what the market capacity looks like. How much limit can you buy? And then do an evaluation, not only by benchmarking against other peer firms to say, right, what, you know, in the boardroom when decisions are being made, they kind of want to know what their competitors or their peers are doing. So that provides one decision-making point, but also just doing the cost analysis of what are the chances of a claim hitting above a certain level. Some other things that aren't covered, loss of trade secrets, obviously not covered. Intellectual property that's lost, once it's out there, it's out there. Third-party patent infringement is not covered by a cyber policy. And then as we mentioned on those violations of things like California's Act or GDPR, some of those fines and penalties, that's still an evolving space about whether those can be covered by the insurance policy or not.
So if a firm goes to get cyber insurance from an insurance company, is the insurance company going to require the firm to actually take some steps to protect itself from cybercrime?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's something we're spending a lot of time on right now. The insurance companies are most concerned with two things: access management and access security. And one way that they're going and evaluating this right now, at least a superficial level, are they're going on to publicly available sites and taking a look at a firm's public security score. It's similar to a credit rating. There's a couple of firms that are providing these. There's BitSite, Security Scorecard is another one. As these are just outside views of a firm's security and their cyber protections. So there could be a lot of problems with that rating. And just like on a credit score, if somebody's gone in and, you know, and taken out a water bill in your name in another state, that might affect your credit score. It's important to go in and evaluate those up front, because that really is the first blush that an insurance company gets of a firm is, what's that online rating look like? We would recommend going in there, you know, probably 180 days before your renewal, and making sure that security scorecard is accurate. We work with firms to do that. That also can be done internally. But that's one of the first things that folks look at from the insurance company's perspective when they're underwriting risk is, what does the public think about these folks? If firms are wanting to purchase ransomware insurance coverage as part of their cyber policy, there are a number of protocols that have to be taken into account here. One of them is just the amount of information required by the insurance companies. Not only are you completing an application for cyber insurance, but then they're providing a supplemental application. We've hosted a number of roundtables on this event with CISOs and IT directors, and they're just a little frustrated with the amount of information that they're having to provide, especially considering it's a bit redundant with what they're already having to provide to their banks and other financial service providers to demonstrate that their systems are secure. But unfortunately, that's where we are right now in this world, is the cyber insurance market wants to see supplemental applications completed, and they are lengthy, they are detailed, and they are required in order to obtain this coverage. So those are some of the administrative things that go on. The underwriters absolutely want to see multi-factor authentication, MFA. This is where you need two devices to get onto one. If that is not in place going forward, we're really struggling to get coverage for folks. It can be possible, but that is going away. That's becoming the equivalent of having a fire extinguisher in your building to get property insurance coverage. That's one that I think will, by 12 months from now, will be an absolute must. Another one that's kind of interesting that we're seeing more and more is these restrictions for employees who have administrative rights or privileges for the system itself, regardless of how large the firm is. So if we're going to a firm of 50 people, or if we're going to a firm of 10,000 folks, the cyber insurance companies are wanting to see that the number of people with admin rights is roughly 2.
Regardless of size.
Yeah, and that's not always achievable, but that's what they're shooting for, is 1 with a backup. Again, is it realistic? Sometimes yes, and it can be done. I was talking to a firm last night that's based overseas, and they really struggled with that because they have 5 different opcos in different regions, and they want to be able to demonstrate that they can get folks on and off a system or upload and download software as needed. They had to move that number down to 2 people, and it was challenging for them. They had to kind of reorganize their own IT infrastructure to respond. They're probably a safer firm now, and the insurance company certainly does feel that way as well. The insurance companies are also wanting to see what the processes are, and they want to see them institutionalized or codified within a firm for how you deal with end-of-life systems, how you deal with data that's no longer required for your firm to hold on to. How are we disposing of these things that we no longer need or use? Because sometimes those can be entry points for bad actors. They want to see that you're going into your administrative files on a regular basis to clean them out. They want to see that that's happening at least every 30 days. And then an important one is, what does your patching process look like? When Microsoft comes out and says, hey, here's 3 or 4 holes that need to be fixed, what does your firm do with that? How long does it take to patch them? And then the one that we're all familiar with is just the ongoing training. The insurance companies want to see that there's a training program in place for employees at every level of the firm, including the top of the firm. And they want to see that these phishing tests that some of us are familiar with, this idea of clicking onto something that you're not supposed to, they don't just want to see that that goes out on May 2nd every year. They want to see that that's a rolling test, that that's ongoing. So that this is an evolving space. It's not a, okay, we all know this is happening, and then do it. So I listed a lot of things there. The MFA is the absolute must. The supplemental application is the absolute must. Those restricted admin accounts are becoming an absolute must. And those other things are soon to follow, I believe.
And looking forward, what do you expect to see in the cybersecurity insurance market? How do you think it's going to evolve?
I think there's going to be 2 ways that we see, 2 tracks of evolution here. I think one of them is going to be, how is the policy going to respond? And then the other one is going to be, what are the requirements to obtain this coverage? I think those are the 2 areas where we're going to see big evolution. As far as how the coverage is going to respond, I think there's going to be continued clarity about which policies will respond to cyber events. I think what Lloyd's did when they clarified you must affirmatively grant coverage or restrict coverage. I think that's going to follow across the board, and there's going to be great clarity around which policies can respond. It may end up in a bifurcation of a number of different cyber policies to choose from. I think there's going to be a continued clarity around how the cyber policy will respond to fines and penalties that result from an infraction of GDPR, California, Australia, any other regulation around privacy and data security. And I think there's going to be clarity on how these policies are going to respond to ransomware attacks. I mean, it's an extortion. So there's already a variety of strategies, there's already a variety of means of responding to these extortion threats that have been excluded, right? Whether they're bad actors that are federally excluded or countries that are just saying you can't respond to it. I think that's going to continue to evolve. From the underwriting requirements, I think this is just going to become similar to a property insurance policy where there just have to be certain protocols in place in order to obtain the coverage. And those are going to be standardized. And it's not going to be a situation where you can still obtain it by finding a new market that'll grant you access to it. I think there's just going to be some assumed risk management protocols that are in place in order to get the coverage.
I think that's a good place to bring us to a close. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Well, I certainly enjoyed the conversation. You know, I would say as firms are going through any sort of renewal process for their cyber insurance, or if they're talking about cyber events at a board level, this is an important time to be proactive with your insurance broker. Reach out to them. Find out if there is something that you can be doing to improve your risk profile with the insurance companies. And also gain clarity about exactly what it is that your insurance policy is responding to, so that you know when the cyber event comes, where to make the first call, what coverage to expect, and what your firm can be thinking about going forward to make sure that coverage is viable.
Right, that's a good way to close. You've been listening to the Engineering Influence podcast presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACEC Liefeld Trust. Thanks for listening.